then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's December the 19th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Well, we're really on a roll out here in Homeland. Once more, we get to welcome home another comrade, Josh D., who has arrived in Idaho. No, I'm not making all these new migrants up, people. I've had some of them on here, like AJ, a few weeks ago. And once these new people do get settled in, I hope I can persuade some of them to do MP3 files for the show here. We can work that out next year. Now, about next year, those of you who are on the Northwest Revolution list, as well as the NSA and FBI monitors who are spying on my computer, will know that I've already told my own private audience on the email list that I have one more major writing project to complete and get published, and I hope to get that done by sometime in January. At that point, once that's done, I'm going to have to cut back on the writing and the creative stuff and let my duties as the party's sole employee and office boy start to take a front seat. I've already stated that for some time now I have held both the party's propaganda minister and national organizer portfolios, so to speak, with the result that I have not been able to do either job well. Now that has to stop. We've reached the point where it's necessary for me to be concentrating on doing at least one of those jobs adequately and full time. And as much as I would like to retire off to some little cabin by a crystal blue lake and spend my remaining years just writing and writing, that can't be. It's pretty clear now that no one else is going to step forward in any time frame soon enough to be useful. And lest it sound like I'm bitching and moaning at you people, no, I'm not far from it. I'm the first to admit that our lack of a national organizer is because my standards are too high, and my requirements as far as character and proven track record go are way too stringent. Basically, this is not a job that can safely be given to internet walk-ins, even though some of those internet walk-ins, for all I know, might be perfect. Okay, I've babbled about all that before and I won't repeat myself. Now what's going to have to happen is that after this one last writing project, or one and a half more writing projects, if you include my New Year's status report on the party that's going to be going out with the January 2014 Northwest Observer. Anyway, after that, I will have to become more or less a full-time office boy to keep the paper flowing, and I'll also have to become the principal of Movement Junior High, writing herd on all the 45-year-old adolescents. It's a stupid job, but somebody's got to do it, and since William Pierce died, no one's even tried, and the middle-aged adolescents have taken over the junior high school. Okay, enough of that. There was an article in the New York Times today on how 479 local sheriffs around the country have stated that they will not enforce gun laws, and needless to say, bright and early this morning, someone sent me a link to this article with words to the effect of, "See, Harold, see, the sheriffs will save us, Harold. They'll save us from Obama. We don't have to get in trouble. The sheriffs will save us." Well, I should add that I also get similar emails with links to the article when some western or southern governor or state legislator so much as mumbles the word secession in some speech to some local Rotary Club in Devil's Outhouse, Wyoming, probably after his fourth martini at lunch.
See, Harold, we don't have to get in trouble or do anything. The Montana State Legislature is going to secede from the Union. The Wyoming Chamber of Commerce is going to make everybody go back to gold and silver. 10 counties in Colorado is going to secede and form their own state. We can all move there and live in Beaver Cleaverville forever. We don't have to do nothing.
Yes, I know that that last is actually being discussed in Colorado, and I wish those people all the best, and I hope that they succeed. Although, needless to say, Obama and the Democrats will never allow another red state to be created. 2 more Republicans in the Senate and more in the House? What would that do to Hillary when her turn comes? Sorry, Charlie, not happening. We live in a one-party state now, remember? And I'm starting to ramble again. Look, I went over this a few weeks ago, and yet hope springs eternal, and the subject keeps popping up, because we white people are so frantically desperate for someone from within the system to give us a sign that all will be well and we don't have to do anything about it. I guarantee you that if someone like, say, Rand Paul, who is a United States Senator, were to make even a few mildly racial noises, within days he would have his own political organization and a following of millions of people. So desperate are we for someone from within the system to take the lead and absolve us of responsibility. I mean, look at the millions who fell so deeply in love with his father, Ron Paul, who was only a congressman and who, by the by, was never one of us. Neither is Rand, by the way. Ron Paul actively drove white nationalists away from his campaigns, using everything from court injunctions to anti-white speeches to police goons to physically drag people away and out of sight of the cameras. I have to say, I never got this infatuation that everybody always seemed to have with Ron Paul. Especially after he just lay down and allowed himself to be robbed blind of all his votes in the New Hampshire primary, not once but twice. Ron Paul could have done us all a solid if he had called the Democrats on the vote fraud in the primaries, but he had been assimilated into the system by then, and so he acted as a good system soldier. He just accepted the decision of his elders and betters, and he laid down and let them walk all over him. Okay. Getting back to the subject of our desire to have someone from within the system write us a permission slip to be brave again. Now, you guys probably don't know what in-elites and out-elites are. This may take some explaining. About 40 years ago, sometime in the early 1970s, long before the internet days, there was an article circulating all over in various tiny little movement magazines and newsletters, which I would give certain parts of my body to have a copy of today, but it seems to have just disappeared. I don't recall seeing it anywhere after about 78 or 79 or so. Laird Wilcox may have a copy stashed somewhere in his files at the University of Kansas. Now, the problem is, I cannot even now recall the title of the article, but it was by someone using the pen name of K.G. Holm, written in the late 60s or early 70s, and it gave a brief rundown of a theory which I've always felt is one of the most pertinent and applicable and accurate as far as describing our own white racial situation in this country, the best I've ever read. I tried to remember certain key phrases for internet searches, but either I just can't remember the right phrases, or else, as is entirely possible, the article was never scanned or digitized onto the internet. We have so much really great stuff from that period, which just never made it onto the net because no one was willing to sit down in front of a terminal and do the typing. I tried doing a Google on K.G. Holm one more time just now, and nothing came up. I'll make a deal with any of you old movement collectors from my generation out there. If any of you know what article I'm talking about, and if you have a copy of it on paper hidden away somewhere in the cardboard box at the bottom of your closet, or wherever it is that you hide all your racist stuff from the little woman like most adolescents hide their pornography from their mothers, could you please send me the article itself or else a photocopy, and I will personally retype it and get it digitized onto the net so it's preserved for all time. Also, if anyone has any copies of the old Trud, T-R-U-D magazine by Doug Kay, which lasted for about a year around 1971 or so, same thing. Send them to me and I will type them and get them onto the net so that they are preserved for all time, which they deserve to be. Now, finally, and I've asked this before, is there anybody out there at all who has actual JPEGs or GIFs or other digitized printable images of the famous George Lincoln Rockwell boat ticket back to Africa? If you do, for God's sake, send them to me. I do not mean photographs of the boat ticket. I do not mean scans. I mean the actual boat ticket in a digitized and reproducible form so we can print and make more boat tickets. Failing all else, if you could send me 3 originals on white paper and not too tattered and dog-eared and stained so that I could at least clean them up with whiteout, I could then make up a crude master copy on a photocopier and produce some of them that way, although the quality wouldn't be very good, and I really, really want a digitized master file so that I can run copies on a printer. The boat ticket back to Africa was the most popular racial item ever produced by the movement, by the ANP or any other group. Like passenger pigeons, there were once literally millions of these things in our movement's skies, so to speak. And like the passenger pigeon, they're now extinct. The internet wiped them out. We need to see if we can do the Jurassic Park trick and bring some of this stuff back from extinction. And I'm rambling again. Okay, back to the home article. The article, as I recall it, postulated as follows. Humanity is guided, led, and sometimes driven by the top 5% of human beings who have that alpha gene that I've referred to on here repeatedly. Now, Holm calls these people elites and divides them into 2 categories. The in-elites, who are part of the system or the power structure and who work from within it, who support it, who keep it going. And the out-elites, who are excluded from the power structure and who are outside of the system but who have the Nietzschean will to power to the point where they are willing to overthrow the system or batter their way in, so to speak. Now, before I go into this any further, I would actually like to see if any of you folks out there can come up with a copy of the K.G. Holm article from 40 years ago before I get into that. I mean, hell, if somebody can find a copy and it's as good as I remember it, I may even read the whole damn thing out, because as I recall it from my wild and uproarious youth, this is the best way I've ever heard all this expressed. Anyway, essentially what the Northwest Front has to do is we have to attract our own small cadre of out elites, people who have that alpha gene, that willingness to go first, who are willing to take on the in elites of the system. Of the top 5% of the white population, essentially it's going to be our 2.5% versus their 2.5%. The vast majority of the population will simply be spectators and will either be in the way or will be rushing to get out of the way, which is what I've been saying all along. And I think I'll shut up now and let someone else take over.
She's back.
Good afternoon, comrades. I know it appears I've been missing in action, so to speak, for the last couple of months, and in a way I have, but not for the reasons some of you have expressed concerns about. I returned to school a while back to finish a degree I started a number of years ago, and the workload became very heavy the last couple of months. I'll admit partly due to some poor planning on my part. Something else I'll admit is that it can be incredibly hard not to throw your pearls before swine, so to speak, by voicing racial truths to people who cannot or will not hear you in order to counter the garbage that's being taught as history, science, sociology, and psychology these days. And that's actually a small part of the difficulties racially aware whites encounter in Jew-run educational institutions. It's hard to even call this education, since it's more about indoctrination into useless Jewish philosophy. But I do need the degree in order to be able to work legally in the field my talents are directing me toward. So onward and upward I go. And it's about education I want to speak today. Many of you have expressed a desire to move to the homeland, but you say you need to finish your education before you can move, so it will be 2, 3, or 4 years before you're able to do so. There are a few of you for whom that is true, because you've already started a degree program where you're currently living at in-state tuition rates. For those of you in that situation, okay, that's a valid excuse because you have to wait at least a year after moving here before you can get into the same type of program at in-state tuition rates over here. And let's face it, in-state tuition is high enough to be paying for something we all know isn't really of much use except to work in a field you probably already know as much about as the person teaching the class. However, many of you could choose to do your program online, as I have done, and then the tuition is the same wherever you live, which means, of course, you could move to the homeland far sooner. I do understand some programs aren't offered online, so there are some exceptions here. However, if you haven't already started, why not consider either moving here first and attending online, or taking the time to settle in while waiting the year to get residency for in-state tuition? There are some advantages to online programs, though, that most don't think about. One of the biggest being you don't have to sit in classrooms with or interact with the animals that inhabit much of higher education. Okay, you might have one as an instructor occasionally, a situation I have so far been fortunate not to have to face. But other than that, it's easy to avoid the animals when going to school online. And even if you do encounter one as an instructor, it's not difficult to keep the interaction to the bare minimum required for the class. I've only had to interact regularly with one of my instructors so far anyway. Online classes are somewhat, a lot, writing intensive, so it's pretty easy to determine which category someone falls into, and to choose to interact only with those whom you recognize as white. Another advantage is that you're not limited by the hours you can work, so full-time work is possible if you need to, as I do. Another significant advantage is that having to write all of your assignments gives you the time to organize your thoughts, so you can take advantage of subtle ways of getting a racial point of view across without risking the ire of the instructor and a possible failing grade, yet test the waters to see if there's anyone reachable attending class with you. Of course, it's easier to do that in some classes than it is in others. In some of the diversity classes I've had to take, I've been able to have some fun and take advantage of asking questions in my discussion board posts for the week that get people thinking and have sparked some interesting out-of-class private discussions. That's a good technique in history, sociology, and psychology classes as well. It can be much harder to do this in a traditional classroom, though, since the discussion can quickly get out of hand, and you might reveal more than you actually want to. And before someone claims I'm ashamed of my race or my beliefs, heaven forbid, there's a time and a place for everything, and sometimes keeping your mouth shut is the better part of wisdom and valor. If you're in the middle of getting an undergraduate or graduate degree, or about to start, and also truly have a desire to move to the homeland and start the process of living the rest of your life in a white world, why not take some time to consider options that will shorten the time it will take you to come home, while at the same time accomplish your career goals? Hail victory, comrades.
Okay, now, among white nationalist people, there are a number of little subsets of individuals, among them a fairly significant minority, who know who H.P. Lovecraft is and who appreciate his supernatural and horror fiction. It's kind of like an insider thing in the movement. See, unlike Ron Paul, Lovecraft was definitely one of us, as I proved in my recent blog post, where I published his poem from 1912 on the creation of niggers. But since Lovecraft's death in 1937, he's developed a pretty eclectic following that includes just all kinds of white people. And I mean that, white people. Interestingly enough, there is only one real common denominator among Lovecraft aficionados. Left-wing, right-wing, hippy-dippy, businessmen, students, intellectuals, slackers who live in their mother's basements. Everybody's into Lovecraft, and they are all white. I have never known a nigger or even an Asian Lovecraftian, and very, very few Jews, I believe. But that doesn't mean that Lovecraft fandom doesn't have some pretty strange manifestations. And one of them, at this time of year, when everyone else is singing and playing Christmas carols, Lovecraftians are singing Cthulhu carols.
Some old press clippings, my uncle's notes, a bas-relief made of clay. The horrors that these convey have given me much dismay. I think I'm starting to go insane. Strange nightmare images haunt my brain. I'm dreaming of a dead city where deep ones swim in depths of night, where Cthulhu's sleeping while stars go creeping until the time when they are right. I'm dreaming of a dead city with angles Euclid wouldn't know, that was built strange eons ago and will soon come up from down below. Dark future ruled by that three-lobed burning eye, when the old one's coming is nigh, and you find that death itself may die.
Got an interesting email a couple of days ago from a longtime RFN listener who wanted to know what happened to someone we used to have on the program quite a lot a couple of years ago. Dry Ice Washington. Why, who did you think I meant? Anyway, for those of you who haven't been listening that long and who don't remember, there was a time when the FCC was on my case about not having quote-unquote minority viewpoints and community representation. And so they were trying to impose a minority quota of sort on the show. So I went down to the bus station and found this old nigger wino named Dry Ice Washington, and I brought him up here and gave him a bottle of nitrate and hosed him down before I let him in the house, and he did a few clips for RFN. Later on, when the Trayvon Martin thing came up, his wife, or woman, or whatever she was, Effie Sue Washington, also did some comments on that incident. Now, I haven't seen Dry Eyes for a while. He's not at the bus station anymore. But it's winter, so he may be in a shelter or in jail or whatever. But I learned a while back, to my surprise, that Dry Ice actually had a political career of his own for a while, sort of. He ran for mayor of Seattle about 10 years ago, as a Democrat, of course, and he did quite well in the primary. The only reason he got beat out was that his opponent was a faggot, and he and his friends provided certain services in the voting booth that we won't get into. Anyway, here is one of Dry Ice Washington's campaign speeches from the Democratic primary in Seattle back around the year 2000 or so, I think it was. As you can see, he wasn't quite such a hopeless drunk back then.
My friends, it is indeed a financial pleasure to have so many of you resemble here today on this suspicious occasion. Now, we have resembled here to elect a new mayor. But before I proceed any further, I must tell you that the treasurer of our club is missing. Yes, he's gone. He is 5 feet, 11 and a half inches tall, and he is $69.80 short. But before we go on any further, we're going to pass up the hat in a few moments to take up that amount. And I do not want any coupons or cough drops put in the hat. Now then, my friends, another thing. On account of the coal company building a high board fence between the mayor's office and the coal yard, it is now necessary that we buy some coal. Now then, I'm not going to take up much of your time here today. It's only about the, it's only about 3 feet and 6 inches past nine now. But as I say, we are here to elect a new mayor, and if I am elected your mayor, the first law what I'm going to pass is that all black cats must stay out of the alley. Now then, I have been your public servant here for some time, and all that you folks have given me for my services so far has been nothing but pig feet. Now then, I like those pig feet. I enjoy them, and I want to thank all of you from the bottom of my heart for those many, many fine pig footsies. However, here's one thing I want to impress upon your mind, and that is this. If you want me to continue on here as your mayor, I simply got to eat higher up on that hog. Now then, of course, my friends, you know that politics is a serious thing to be inveigled in. But after all, politics concern only the two parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. But the question arises as to what is a Democrat. My friends, a Democrat is a man that don't give a darn what happens just as long as it happens to a Republican. Now, vice versa. Now then, where did politics start? It started way back yonder in the times when George Washington Machine crossed the Delaware. And when he got on the other side of the Delaware, who did he see standing over there? Napoleon with his bones apart. And what did they do? They sit right there on the banks of the Delaware and they sign the Declaration of Independence. Now then, my friends, we are here to get the votes. And I want the ladies' votes. Bless the dear ladies. For what could be any sweeter than to have a darling little wife that every morning, when you get up to go to your labor, to show you to that front door, pull the arms around your neck, and gently and sweetly kiss you goodbye at the front door. And just as soon as you're out of sight, brothers, what will she do? Run right around to the back door and kiss some other man good morning.
Amen, brother.
Amen, me son. I've been at both doors. I now then want to get your votes, my friends. And I rest my case and leave the matter in the hands of Brother Boone.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to talk about a book called Hellstorm by Thomas Goodrich. This is a book dealing with 1945, particularly after the Yalta Conference, and it deals with the great hatred that the United States and the Soviet Union and Britain had for Germany, all the various things that happened because of that. It starts out talking about the Dresden bombing and how desperate the fight became for Germans late in the war. They really felt that they were in a struggle for their existence, and they really felt that if they gave up, they would be utterly destroyed, and they felt they were in a situation that was really impossible. The fight became very desperate, and late in the war, you really ended up being reduced to elderly men and also the Hitler Youth. And both of these factions tended to be much more fanatical because they were not as burnt out as Weimarkt was at that time. Another group that was particularly fanatical in fighting were the foreign SS officers. Particularly, it talks about the werewolves and how they used a lot of anti-tank weapons, and also the desperate defense of Breslau by Karl Hank. Now, initially, the Germans in the West felt that the Americans would be kinder to them, and this was somewhat true, although the Americans were really not that great either. Ultimately, the British ended up being the kindest. Now, this book goes into a lot of various punishments that were meted out to German civilians and party members alike. They're really quite disturbing. In fact, I would almost suggest that you may want to be careful about reading this book. You may find it very upsetting. However, I do find the epilogue of this book much more inspiring. Some of the interesting highlights of the book, it talks about denazification and the interrogations that went on, and also the fact that there were many people that were imprisoned and often taken to the Soviet Union for a couple of years, taken to work camps. These interrogations are very interesting because oftentimes people were asked if they were in the party, and if you said yes, you were very severely beaten. And so a lot of people ended up saying no when they realized how brutalized they would be. I thought that was a very interesting moral dilemma to put oneself in that situation and other situations that could potentially be similar to it, and ask yourself when you should say yes and when you should say no. I mean, I'm all for prudence and I'm all for being functional, but I do see a certain heroism in those who said yes, even knowing that they would face awful consequences if they did. And I'm also very inspired by those individuals who stayed and worked on all the rebuilding projects. Now, in the aftermath of the war, there were a lot of American soldiers that were walking around, and oftentimes they would tempt local women because they would have candy bars or stockings or possibly cigarettes. And a lot of the local women were tempted to date them and become war brides, and I often think that was a sign of opportunism. And I really respect the people that stayed behind and worked very hard to rebuild cities like Dresden. The rebuilding of Dresden and other cities was really an amazing feat. You saw signs of cleanup already by the late 40s and early 50s. And by 1964, the center of Dresden was rebuilt. And then in 1985, an opera house in Dresden was rebuilt and recommissioned. And then, after the fall of East Germany, there was really even more restoration projects started in particularly the eastern cities that still showed a lot of scarring from the war. Today, I understand that Dresden really, it looks like it never even happened. It's been, from what I understand, completely restored. I think all of that is very inspirational. The recovery of Germany has really been amazing, and it's one of the things that I really admire about the German people. I know that it's frightening and very risky, but I really would hope that someday one of our German comrades will come on our show. And so that's something I really look forward to, and I understand if they can't or want to, but it's really something that I hope will happen. So I thank my fans for sending me material on occasion. I have to say, I still like the idea of holding a book in my hand, or I suppose if I had a small Kindle, that would be nice as well. But I do thank you for your support and sometimes sharing books with me. So I hope you enjoyed this review, and have a good night. Also, Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays, whatever you're celebrating in terms of Yule, the solstice. So thank you for listening, and I also would wish you a very Happy New Year.
Let's see. Would two Cthulhu carols in one show be too much? Oh, why not? Don't worry, next week will be our Christmas program, and I'll have proper Christmas music on then, but for now, to hell with it. It's my show, and I feel like being silly.
Nurses always stop to check on me. Locked away for my security. Oh, these voices are to blame for this catastrophe. But my one wish on Solstice Eve is as plain as it can be. All I want for solstice is my sanity, my sanity, my sanity. Gee, if I could only have my sanity, then I could have a happy solstice. Imaginary voices make me want to say, Thigluiwaganagalofatagin. Gosh, oh gee. How happy I'll be when that's out of my noggin. All I want for solstice is my sanity, my sanity, oh, my sanity. Gee, if I could only have my sanity, then I could have a happy solstice. Imaginary voices make me want to say, Thigluiwaganagalofatagin. Gosh, oh gee, how happy I'll be when that's out of my noggin. All I want for solstice is my sanity, my sanity, oh my sanity. Gee, if I could only have my sanity, then I could have a happy solstice. Gee, if I could only have my sanity, then I could wish you happy solstice.
I have received two emails this week on the subject of white children and the youth experience, if you want to call it that, of white kids, so I'll try to answer those now. The first comes from one of our female comrades in Virginia, Leslie, who has just given birth to a daughter. Congratulations, Leslie. And she emails me to ask, Dear HAC, how can I make sure that my child grows up to be normal and racially aware, and how can I make sure that she is never corrupted by liberalism and race mixing? Hoo boy, Leslie, that is a problem that cuts right to the nub of what we're doing. Now, I could be really facile and tell you that the best way to do that is to fight to create the Northwest American Republic and make sure that your little girl grows up in a new white nation, but that isn't really helpful for you right now, is it? Okay, I'll take a crack at this, but I have to remind you first, in case you weren't aware, that I'm not exactly the go-to guy on this topic. Now, a few of you know what happened to me in the 1980s, but most don't. Like so much of the movement, I'm kind of a textbook case on how not to do it. My own children, four of them, were taken away from me in the late 1980s and were most assiduously raised by my ex-wife and my family in Ireland and North Carolina to hate me and everything to do with white nationalism. My daughter still sends me nasty emails once in a while, or at least someone using her name does. I have no idea if these things are authentic or not. That's another bad thing. The Goat Dancers found her on the internet, and if she didn't think I was insane before, I'm sure they've taken care of that. I'm not going to get into that, and the only reason I'm mentioning it is because the first thing you have to make sure of, Leslie, is that you are there for your kids and they're not taken away from you by the state or by your own family using the law, and that can happen. It has happened. Do not do stupid things like naming your son Adolf Hitler like that bird brain couple in New Jersey did a few years ago. Their son was taken away from them because of his name. And yes, the evil people who rule us will do that. And no, I did not make up some of those horror stories I cited regarding It Takes a Village in my Northwest novels. Some of those things actually have basis in fact, like the horrible Christine case that Edgar Steele defended. So the first thing that you have to do for your children, Leslie, is to live as close to an outwardly normal life as you can. Okay, this begs the question of what constitutes normal these days. Well, let me put it this way. You need to outwardly live a life of conformity. Now, this is a very bad example, but when Ferdinand and Isabella expelled the Jews from Spain in 1492, thousands of them, rather than leave Spain, pretended to convert to Christianity, and they lived there for centuries as outward Roman Catholics, and they gorged themselves on pork in public while secretly maintaining Jewish religious practices and Jewish religious instruction in their homes. Now, these were called Marrano Jews, which means pig. And by the way, that was not the Spanish term for them, which was converso. Marrano is a swear word, a Jewish Ladino word for these secret Jews, which was given to them in contempt by their own people who refused to convert. Basically, Marrano was the name given to Jews who were considered to be traitors to the Jewish religion by compromising and pretending to be Roman Catholics. It's another historical example of the fact that a lot of anti-Semitism actually comes from other Jews. In a sense, racially conscious white people with children, in order to keep their families together and in order to maintain the gainful employment necessary to support those families, have to be kind of secret racists like the Marrano Jews, never letting their employers or the community around them suspect. And this, by the way, is one of the reasons that we need to get your asses up here and start forming communities in the Northwest. It is much, much easier, so much easier to raise children and to exist in an area where you have like-minded people around and where you have your own circle of friends and you can go to the same picnics and same barbecues as other white nationalists. You know, I've never understood why we keep running away from each other, but I'm sorry, that's another topic. I won't wander off on that. Anyway, in order to survive and prevent the dictatorship from taking your children away, you need to learn to live a lie. And that can be very hard for some people, especially when your kids start school and they start to become corrupted by the crawling chaos around them. Now, that's the next step, Leslie. Homeschool, homeschool, homeschool. This will probably mean that one parent must stay home to educate the children. And realistically, that will probably be you, unless you're the one earning $100,000 per year at some yuppie corporation, and your husband is part of the man's session, as it's called, which is entirely possible. The unemployment rate for white males in the Obama depression is over 20%, so I would imagine that a lot of husbands are going to be staying home and homeschooling the kids for quite a while now. Homeschooling is a whole subject unto itself. I know a lot of white families with children who do it, but I myself just don't know enough about the process to sit here and shout the odds on it. I do know that there's all kinds of help you can get on the internet, including places to order textbooks, and that a lot of these sources on the internet, although they don't say so outright, are, shall we say, racially conscious, in the sense that the material you order from them will not have black and Asian faces plastered all over it. Now, I'll move on to what I think is the nub of your question. How do you give your children a racial education in the middle of an open-air toilet like Obama's America? There are certain aids available to you. For example, a lot of conservative and Christian publishers still publish older storybooks and textbooks and young adult history, etc., that's not corrupted. You should always read or view beforehand any book or movie or image that goes in front of your child's eyes, and make sure that it's not racially harmful. I knew a guy once who had a little boy and girl, and he actually created his own homemade, cleaned-up Sesame Street DVDs with all the nigger faces and all the lefty liberal horse shit removed. He made a bunch of these DVDs, and he told me that he always had to remove at least half of every program because it was racially poisonous or contaminated in some way. But the kids were able to learn their alphabet and learn to count and whatnot from Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch and Cookie Monster without seeing a bunch of unnecessary niggers and wild-haired feminist bitches teaching little girls to hate men, so forth and so on. Now, a good rule of thumb I've found, or rather those who have kids have found, is that if you have toddlers or children below 10 or 11, don't let them watch anything on TV that was made after 1965, which pretty much means not having any cable TV at all. Although you probably should have a DVD player specifically for those older movies like Fantasia, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Huckleberry Hound cartoons, maybe old Amos and Andy DVDs if you want to start their racial education early. That doesn't mean that there aren't good movies and cartoons and whatnot of a more recent vintage that you can show them, but you always need to make sure you sit down and watch everything that your kids see beforehand, because liberalism and Jew propaganda is very insidious, and it always starts with a few small drops of poison in a white child's ear. But all the time, you will have to compete with the filth and the poison of modern left liberal pop culture and entertainment. It's everywhere. And the filth isn't just filthy. To a child, it's bright and shiny and wonderful and attractive. And of course, everybody's doing it. No child wants to be all alone, out of step, and left out of everything. And if they feel that you are keeping them away from having friends and having fun, that can develop into a resentment problem, and if they resent you, then they will resent and reject what you're trying to teach them. Now let's cut to the chase. Your children must love and respect and admire you as a person, so that they will trust you and believe what you tell them when everyone and everything around them is telling them something different. Now that's a very hard order to fill. And since I myself personally was never allowed to put any of this into practice, I'm really not the guy you should be asking. So here's Andy.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. Today I'm going to go over a few housekeeping notes since I've observed some interesting trends pop up lately, and it's likely the case that some spaced repetition is due on these subjects. This is all driven by message board remarks, comments on the party website, and various social media things I've seen lately. And if you think I'm talking about something you personally did, that's not the case at all. Unless something truly remarkable happens, individual cases are rarely brought up by any of the Radio Free Northwest contributors. Firstly, Mr. Covington and I seem to attract a very interesting type of criticism about how we approach the ideas and behavior of other white nationalists. This particular issue tends to relate very closely to the subject of white unity. In the last couple of months, Radio Free Northwest has covered the reality of white unity, and to repeat the truth of the matter, it does not exist. Aside from that, it has to be pointed out that we genuinely don't mean anyone ill whatsoever. When we criticize or provide alternative opinion, it's because we're trying to help someone, and frequently, everyone. A lot of people aren't quite sure how to respond to reasonable levels of concern or criticism, and I can understand that to a certain extent. Like it or not, the vast majority of people in the white nationalist movement haven't been in the sort of situation in society where criticism is offered in a constructive manner, and I don't fault them for it. In almost every case, criticism and opposing opinions are offered in a helpful, well-intentioned manner, and to be fair, that's something which must be learned through experience. As an example, early in my career, a very well-meaning manager had to critique something I did, and they did so solely because of their experience. It had nothing to do with how well I did my job or the good things I intended to do. Rather, it was simply advice from someone who knew what they were talking about. Just because my intentions were good doesn't mean I was doing the right thing. That, more than anything else, should inform anyone worried about how the Northwest Imperative affects so-called white unity. Further, I also understand there are different types of people and most of them don't generally like conflict or controversy. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. In fact, there's a lot right with it. If nothing else, it shows you're not trying to cause problems. Quite a few people out there might wish we tried out a different approach. Mr. Covington will inform us every time he's reminded that a person can catch more flies with honey rather than vinegar. As Mr. Covington says, we're not trying to catch flies, we're trying to change the world. Imagine for a moment how things would be if we weren't as direct as we are. What point would we actually make if we weren't honest about what we observe in the movement and about white people in general? Most people on Radio Free Northwest have engaged in long discussions about the history of the white nationalist movement, so I won't do that here. But remember, all the harsh things we've said are totally true. We've talked about individual and movement activities, behaviors, and tendencies which have to change. If we don't say so, no one will. That goes for all cases, even those involving the first taboo, where we can't actually say who we're talking about or else people will really throw a temper tantrum. Nevertheless, I've got to cover a few things I've seen quite a bit of lately, and not everyone is going to be happy with me. Again, I'm not talking about anyone specific. I'm really not. In the last few months, I've been contacted in all sorts of ways about white nationalist infighting and other things the party has said in public, both via Radio Free Northwest and other means of communication. My remarks today are due to many people challenging the way Mr. Covington has delivered his material and, in a few cases, challenges to the way I deliver my own commentary. None of these challenges has been inappropriate per se, but I have to observe that when we engage the challengers, they usually don't want to remark any further. I take this to mean they don't have a tangible reason for being cross with the party. In addition to some folks not liking our approach on RFN, others take issue with our concerns about the T-shirt youth. This one especially gets me because most people who correspond with the party understand us on this one. We don't dislike the T-shirt youth at all, and have never said otherwise. Granted, when a T-shirt youth becomes a T-shirt 30-something, there's a bigger problem and we might actually criticize them in earnest, but that's a subject for another day. In the case of genuine T-shirt youth, we know things are rough for a lot of our people, and it's not unexpected, especially in Obama's America, for young people to end up in a bad way without an escape. The worst thing we've ever said about the T-shirt youth as a whole is that they don't understand how to make their way in the world, and that's absolutely true. Usually it's followed up with some sort of helpful instruction which should be enough to demonstrate we're not coming down on them like we're accused of. If anything, everyone listening would do well to stop deliberately missing our point when we try to help other white nationalists. Sometimes I start to wonder if people get mad at the party because our criticism of others hits a little too close to home, since they themselves aren't broken down enough to make necessary personal changes. My last note is going to be on the possibility of the Northwest Agency recently discussed on Radio Free Northwest. I saw quite a few reactions to this material, and they bother me. Really, guys, I'm not talking about any one person, especially on this point. The last time the subject of party professionalization was discussed with respect to the Northwest Agency, quite a few of you publicly expressed their immense desire for the party to get this agency up and running, because part of its anticipated operation would be to assist with the physical and possibly financial end of migration. While nothing is wrong with getting excited about and anticipating party activity, the overwhelming bulk of the praise came from people who, for whatever reason, decided they would only be able to come home if the party were to bring them home. Guys, here's the deal. I'm not trying to bust you for being in a bad spot, but you need to understand something about this potential agency. It's only a possibility at this point, so you can't rely on it coming into existence. Secondly, were it to exist, it would have very limited capabilities outside the homeland, and were it to bring a person or a family home, the party would have to be sure we could get a return on the effort and funds expended for those migrants. One of the major ideas behind the Northwest Imperative is that the white nationalist movement is in the position it's in because we've waited for other people to solve our problems for us. That's exactly what the party can't endorse, and a large part of our commentary is, on some level, an attempt to get you to act on your own behalf so you're later able to act on our race's behalf. A very significant portion of the reaction to the discussion of bringing people home on the party's dime was that some aspiring migrants have decided to wait until the help is available. Aside from the fact that this may never come, the type of reaction I saw from every quarter is exactly what we're trying to avoid. I see a lot of people more or less deciding to wait for someone else to save them. Now, really, track with me on this. I'm not trying to make fun of you or put you down or make you feel bad. That's never the point here. And, in a slight switch from the norm, I'm not even trying to shame you. just the opposite. If nothing else, I don't want you to choose to be the sort of person that waits for someone else to rescue them. Everyone listening to me right now must realize what this strategy has done to the white race. Quite some time ago, it might have been possible to reclaim the entire United States, but we decided we were going to wait for someone else to do it for us. I'm not on RFN to show you how smart I am. I'm not on RFN to insult you, and I am certainly not on RFN just because I like talking into a microphone on my computer. I'm here first for the Northwest American Republic, and second, because Northwest migration is good for everyone who participates, and I'd like to help other white people become involved in securing an existence for our people and a future for white children. Aside from the white character material on RFN for its first 3 years, I've delivered several discussions on the subject, particularly on how the movement has failed to understand its own character and the talk I gave on solving problems. I wonder why it is that so many don't seem to grasp the concept that personal change is necessary, even if only for their own benefit. The party repeatedly reminds each and every one of you, you can migrate if you want to. What we mean by this is that normal, effective, functional individuals are capable of making cross-country moves when they need to. Sometimes, they do it on a whim. Admittedly, that's not very common, but it does happen. Why in the world can't our people do it, especially for a good reason? Again, this isn't about endlessly pointing out other people's flaws or demonstrating how wonderful I am. The Northwest Front desperately needs everyone to answer the question I just asked. Why can't our own people do something as normal as a cross-country move? At this point in time, the party is only asking you to do something very basic and completely possible. Is it a lack of employment? You have to get a job anyway. The party isn't making a problem for you. Is it the potential loss of a home? There's a very good chance that was going to happen anyway. The party isn't making a problem for you. Is it a family situation? That situation would exist even if the party had never been formed. The party isn't the problem here either. Normal people can navigate these situations whenever they need to, and they most certainly don't rely on others to make problems go away. One thing which has always baffled me is that throwing white nationalism into the mix seems to completely ruin any possibility of handling personal affairs correctly. I completely respect the revolutionary aspirations many of you have, but let's not run before we can walk. I certainly don't want any of you to give up on yourselves just because you're confronted with normal American problems. Right now, you're not being asked to become revolutionary elite. You're only being asked to become functional in society. Hail victory, comrades.
Right, I was originally going to have nothing but Cthulhu carols on this segment, but after some thought, I realized that not everybody out there gets the joke, so I started looking for something else appropriate for the approaching Christmas holidays. I thought about it for a while, and I decided, what says Christmas better than a nice, bloody, misogynistic murder ballad? This is Walter Forbes.
Polly, oh Polly, over yonder she stands. Gold rings on her fingers, her lily white hands. Come along, pretty Polly, and go along with me. They roamed over dell. They roamed over mountain. They roamed over dell. She heard through the morning the sound of a bell. Willie, oh Willie, I'm feared of your way. They went a little further, and what did she spy? They went a little further. fine. Polly, pretty Polly, you're guessing just right. Polly, pretty Polly, you're guessing just right. I finished your grave, I was digging last night. Stabbed her to the heart, and her heart blood did flow. He stabbed her to the heart, and her heart blood did flow. Then down in her grave, pretty Polly must go. He threw the sod o'er her and turned to go home. He threw the sod o'er her. Then left little birds for to weep and to mourn. Polly, pretty Polly, over yonder she stands. Polly, pretty Polly, over yonder she stands.
All right, the second question I was asked this week about young life in Obama's America comes from Jake in Ohio. It goes as follows. Dear HAC, have you any advice on how a racially conscious white male can survive in a multiracial and multiculturally diverse high school, since you apparently did? Well, yeah, I suppose you could say I survived, although the young man who came out certainly was not the same person as the boy who went in 3 years before. Jake then goes on to lay some details of his wonderful experiences over the past few years on me, which I won't recount here because they might identify the school and him. And the FBI and the NSA analysts are almost certainly parsing these shows, trying to isolate anyone who's in touch with me at all. I know because some people have been visited and questioned about me in the Northwest Front, whose sole connection to me was to be Facebook friends, that kind of thing. Well, on the upside, Jake, Chapel Hill High School made me what I am today, for better or worse. And I can tell you right now that based on what you're telling me, you will at least never, ever become a liberal or a Democrat. Now, you may or may not decide to come home after you graduate, Jake. You may or may not decide to participate in the movement as an adult. You may or may not turn to drugs or alcohol or stupidity of some kind in an effort to recover. But I can tell you now, you will never be the same. You will never cast a vote for any asshole with a D beside his name, and you will never forget. Now, this was over 4 decades ago in my case, and I know full well that Chapel Hill High School in 1970 was a garden of roses compared to any similar school today. The Bubble Lips had no guns that I ever saw, only knives and primitive brass knuckles made out of rings on all their fingers. Oh, and those rat-tooth combs that they used to have with the long prong on it that they could use like an ice pick. And plus, of course, whatever clubs they could pick up off the ground or happened to be handy. The only drugs we had in school were marijuana and LSD. I never heard or saw of any heroin, and crack hadn't even been invented yet. Plus, in those days, there was still some remnant of the old social order, and the niggers understood that civil rights and flower power or not, they would not be allowed to go too far. At least not to the point where they hurt or seriously inconvenienced the darling little progeny of the university clique that ran Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Although I didn't quite grasp this at the time. Now, in those days, the niggers were still to some degree afraid of the police and prison, which doesn't apply today. Of all the crap that my parents and various authority figures tried to lay on me during my years at CHHS, What always struck me as the most outrageous and bird-brained was this rap about, oh, just suck it up, it's only two more years, it's only another year, it's only six more months, just be quiet and keep your nose clean and stay out of trouble for that long and then you'll be out of there and you won't ever have to mess with any of this nonsense again. Which in those days was their way of saying that I would never again be forced into contact with blacks. Boy, did they get that wrong. Anyway, the idea was that I was seriously now, expected to graduate in June of 1971 and then just forget about the past 3 years like they'd never happened and go shuffling on to my wonderful middle-class life that America was still promising to those of us who conformed. My parents and the other adults involved seriously believed that I would do that. I don't know why, but they did. I didn't, and I hope that you won't either, Jake. Now, if there's ever going to be any hope, we can't keep on running away, and we can't keep forgetting every time we're out of the immediate sight of their ugly, nappy-headed faces and the sound of their booga-booga. Of course, that no longer applies so much. In urban areas like your city, just as a matter of daily life, never mind school, it's really, really hard to stay out of their reach. I mean their physical reach, where they can assault you. The cops say that the official firing distance is 21 feet, which they calculate is how long it can take a nigger to charge and be on a police officer with his knife or his teeth before the officer can react and fire, which is why they're supposed to fire if the coon gets any closer than that. Now, where can you go in your city, Jake? On the street, in a store, wherever, where at any given time you are always more than 21 feet from a nigger, or where you couldn't find yourself less than 21 feet away from one at any point. Now, that's your first survival lesson for an integrated high school, Jake. Learning how to keep your distance and fly under their radar while navigating the halls, getting from one place to the other, is crucial. It can be tricky and dangerous, especially if you're marked as a racist like I was. First rule of survival in high school, prison, the military, or any forced contact situation where you're not allowed to run away like white boys always do. Know where the niggers are. Know their habits. Avoid multiples of them if at all possible. Niggers are creatures of habit, and they tend to congregate in certain stairwells, bathrooms, classrooms, and other parts of the school at different times of day. Know their migratory patterns, so to speak. Know the jungle that you live in. Think ahead. Plan your route, moving from class to class to avoid them. Now, if it means leaving the building and going around three sides of a square on the outside to get from point A to point B without passing close enough to a pack for them to notice you, you do that. Because remember, you are all alone. And if you are attacked or robbed or otherwise victimized by these black beasts, no one will help you. Because all of the white kids and the white teachers and every white man in the school is too weak and soft and timid and frightened. I think for me that was probably the worst, Jake. The sheer shame of it. Knowing that we were the descendants of the greatest warrior race in the world, a race that had literally conquered the world, and then to see my fellow students and the faculty and the administration and the media cowering and groveling in front of these creatures who were quite clearly not only not even equal to us, but they weren't us at all. They're some kind of monkey. Okay, Jake, I just did some calculations in my head and I'm about to run over time, so we'll take this up again next week. That'll be a great topic for a Christmas show. How to survive in an integrated high school. Plus, next week, I promise you, I'll have some actual Christmas music for you folks and not just Cthulhu carols. But for the moment, our time is up, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.